top of that, you see a green, a little slot, and that's the reed track that was discovered, obviously, as part of the, or in the flow from the early stairs that vacancies, and that tiny little red portion, if you can barely make it out, is a 3.97-acre track here, which has produced some hundreds of millions of dollars of revenues, oil revenues. We have a couple of graphs.
It was the red track, the vacancy as well?
Yes, it was all vacancy. I'm sorry, Your Honor. The vacancy was established in the green track. The day it was established, that was Pat Reed, who was the Reed and Turner, a little cross-file. Reed conveyed to Turner the 3.97-acre track. Later, Reed, people were busy in those days. Later, Reed sold the minerals on it to Bryant, contrary to his deed, and that actually formed the basis of the early 1934 litigation, was the conflict between the claims of titles based on Reed's conveyances. The trial court granted summary judgment for the defendants and denied the state's motion for partial summary judgment. The record we had filed with the court is voluminous. It includes hearings on temporary injunction. It includes affidavits. It includes massive depositions and discovery. For purposes of this, we have filed a two-volume appendix with the court that shows just extracts from the summary judgment proof. And today we filed with the court just a small packet of materials, all extracted from the summary judgment record. These two graphs really show kind of what the state got and what the Turner defendants, as we call them, got. This, the graph on the left shows losses through 1988, and that was at the time the case was tried on temporary injunction. The testimony of temporary injunction was that there is approximately as much oil still in the ground to be produced as there has been produced, and that's projected, I think, on the basis of $20 a barrel, which may or may not. And we don't hold us to it in terms of exacts, but this is the rough portion, both past and future, that goes to permanent school fund, and that's which went and will go in the future unless there's a remedy to the Turner defendants. Now, as we see the case, in some ways it's awfully straightforward, but it's obviously terribly complicated by the fact of passage of time, because these events are 1934. The operative events, by and large, occurred then. So we are litigating the past. But it is clear as a matter of law that in 1934, Turner was the agent of the state of Texas. The Relinquishment Act made him the agent of the state of Texas. By that point, the Texas Supreme Court had decided Green versus Robeson, which constitutionally made him, and said the only way you can constitutionally construe the Relinquishment Act is to make the surface owner the agent of the state for purposes of executing a lease of its minerals. It also was settled law at that time, the law of agency, that was as settled as it could ever have been. The early Texas Supreme Court decision in Shannon versus Marmaduke had been on the books for 80 years by then, I think, saying that agent self-dealing, that is dealing with the principal property, is a classic violation of agency duties. And the body of Texas law that has existed is uninterrupted since Shannon versus Marmaduke. So the case becomes very simple if we just say Turner is the agent and apply a conventional agency principle, because he clearly, we think, from the summary judgment proof, violated those notions by self-dealing with the principal property. The record is replete with evidence to support that, and the Court of Appeals, in denying us relief, assumed that our proof would show, and did show, that Turner schemed a lease, a straw man lease, with a cohort of his named Fastin that was simply a pass-through device whereby he would reacquire the working interest, and that's what he did promptly after the lease was executed.
Did Turner... He clearly possessed the executive rights.
This is not an executive rights case.
Can you sort of clarify why that's so?
Well, because this is the state's minerals and it's governed by the Relinquishment Act. And it's our view that Turner's duties are at least greater than that of the executive rights holder. I mean, this is, I think this case is determined within the four corners of the Relinquishment Act, whatever it means then and whatever it means now with respect to the relationship between Turner and the state. The state owned the minerals. They were exclusive to state minerals. Hank Turner had no title to the minerals whatsoever. Under the Act, as we understand it, he had the authority to execute an oil and gas lease and the duty to share with the state all proceeds from that oil and gas lease by the Act.
What if Faskin had been not, in your view, a straw man?
It would be a different case, clearly.
Why?
You know, why, if this was a totally arm's length and Turner did not reacquire the title?
No, if he later reacquired it because Faskin said, look, I want to retire, whatever reason he gave, but he said, I want out of this thing. And I come to you first, but I might go to anybody else. If that were the evidence, what difference would it make to the state?
Well, I suppose it does matter in terms of, I think I take the case of Neighbors versus McCord, which is a Texas Supreme Court case of a duty case. There, the agent did reacquire the principal's property shortly thereafter. And the Supreme Court treated it as if it were a case of total good faith on the part of the agent. But in the process said, you simply cannot deal with the principal's property. You may not make undisclosed dealings with the principal's property. Now, I suppose at some point in time, a decade passes, that may be a different matter. There is at least an argument from the state's point of view that any time its agent participates in profits from the lease, the agent has minimally the duty to share the proceeds. That is not our situation. Our situation is, as we see it, an agent misdealing, concocting an arrangement whereby, over the passage of time, profited enormously at the state's expense.
But if the state thought it got a good deal at the time, or was willing to accept the deal, how can the state complain that it might have gotten a better deal?
Well, I guess I have to take you, I mean, I think I have to revert or advert again to the law of agency. Kinsback, I think, is the case that's most clearly in point, which was most recently cited by this court and by Justice Cornyn in the Krim opinion. Kinsback says just that. You may recall the Kinsback case. The plaintiff thought he got a good deal. It's a sale of a contract. He learns after he sold the contract, which he thought was a beneficial transaction, that his agent, also happened to be named Turner, had got $5,000 profit on the side for putting it together, undisclosed to him. He sues for the $5,000, sues Turner, his agent, and sues the person who put him up to it. This court had no problem saying he recovers all of it, gets either one of them. It is an undisclosed profit. He doesn't have to renounce the beneficial transaction. He's entitled to keep the transaction. That's the law of agency. So that's why I say, I think it's a settled law of agency in this state. And it's settled for good reasons, frankly. That is, we can't really carry on business out there, transactions in this state or any other place for that matter, if you can't trust your agent. And if your agent is free to go off and if he can slip by with the profits and never have to disgorge them, there's simply no restraint whatsoever. And we do not see, as a matter of public policy or a matter of law, in fact, we see it just the other way, why an agent under the Relinquishment Act wouldn't be obligated to carry just as much duty as a conventional agent.
Well, let me suggest one to you.
All right.
Under the text of the statute in Section 2, there is some language at the beginning of it, which is curious. It authorizes the owner to lease, quote, upon such terms and conditions as such owner may deem best.
That's right.
Subject only to the provisions of this Act and reservations herein. Why doesn't that give this agent more flexibility or authority or less duty than he would have in another circumstance?
I suppose that argument can be made. As we see it, the Texas, of course, we have to remember that this Act is not to be read literally. It is to be read in the context of the decisions by the Green case and the Empire case, which both said these are the state's minerals, cannot be conveyed. They are constitutionally protected trust funds. And the only thing the agent can do is execute an oil and gas lease and share equally with the state any benefits that flows from it. Now, it is correct to say, I believe, as the law now said in 1934, that the General Land Office did not have authority at that point to reject the lease. So the discretion on the part of the agent to execute a lease, I think that is, that piece of it is accurate. On the other hand, I would think that turns the argument the other way. If we have to trust this agent by statute, and this is, by the way, this is a statute which everyone in this court has said every time they had a chance is to be construed strictly in favor of the state, strictly in favor of the preservation of the trust fund. If we have to trust the agent by statute, then he has to perform his duties fairly to us. Otherwise, the state is helpless to protect its mineral interests. I think that's the response I would make to you in this context.
The argument specifically on the other side, as I understand it, is given the exigencies of oil and gas development, this is not such a good deal. The state wants to bear the risk. The state ought to get more of the benefits. If it doesn't, it shouldn't. What's the answer to that?
Well, after all of this time. Sure, I'm sure. The argument is a hindsight argument. I agree. And it seems to be surface appeal. I think if we come back to what we're dealing with here and begin with first principles, which is we're dealing with constitutionally created trust funds. We're dealing with the state and giving to the surface owner an inordinate power to execute an oil and gas lease with clearly a taxing commensurate duties with it. And those duties are, as the duties of any agent, to treat fairly with its principal, disclose the dealings, and not cut side deals. And I'd have to respond to you. I would make the argument that is made in Kinsback. That's precisely the argument that was rejected by the court in Kinsback. You're coming in now, you love this deal when I've got this contract to sell, whatever it was, you love the deal. And now you find out I got a little on the side, but why should you complain? That's the argument they're making. And that's why the case, it seems to me, is relatively simple in a conventional agency analysis, and we see nothing, given the settled law in this state, that would divert you from applying conventional agency principles to a situation such as
the state. Is there any time in which the state would have lost its right to make this complaint? May our successors be trying 1934 cases 200 years from now?
That's a little shocking, and I agree. This is inordinately troubling, just as a gut matter. But the statute of limitations does not run against the state of Texas. I think it's settled law. I suppose, in trying to prepare myself for questions of this nature, I tried to think about what are the answers, and one of the reasons I think in our supplemental brief we began to talk about constructive trust and importing some equitable notions in this case, that I suppose at some stage remedies may be different depending on how it's sorted out, but our problem
stage. That stage is not 57 years.
Well, I suppose that's with this year. We're here to try to go back to go to trial, and obviously we're not abandoning our claim for all undisclosed profits, which we think is the conventional remedy. In order not to shock the court so far that you won't hear us on the merits, we at least have to say, I think, in candor, that the passage of time is a worrisome matter, not legally, but instinctually. Instinctively. And so there apparently are other remedies that could be crafted here that might take into account that. But the reality is, and as strange as it may seem, the state did not learn of this effectively until shortly before this lawsuit was filed in the context of another case that this court heard in a related matter, Ex Rel Pressler. It was, in the course of that case, which was another one of these 1934 the Pecos Field cases, that the state unearthed the documents and so much of the materials which are now the basis for this proof. Now,
was this something that was not available in the public record?
I'm not sure where
on the public record that found out about this case considerably before the 1980s.
Well, obviously pieces of it might have been available in the public record. The understanding between Turner and Faskin, that Turner was going to pay the bonus, pay for drilling the well, and take all the profits, none of that was of the public record.
Is it your position, Mr. Richards, that from from the point that Judge Wheeler reformed the lease between Turner and Faskin, that Turner could have no other beneficial business dealings regarding this this lease?
I think our argument on that is that it fully disclosed, I think our has to be, it fully disclosed in principle that that would be possible for him to have business.
Have to gain prior approval by the state.
Well, fully, at least fully disclosed, though. And I think that's the duty of the agent. Now, it's hard to make the case if the lease is sold at Humble and he buys stock at Humble. And that's obviously, we go down to Tiny somewhere, we slide off the hill here. But in the meantime, it's, if at some point he's got to disclose if he's going to have personal dealings with the principal property, that seems to me the duty of his agency. And we, that's our view.
Mr. Richards, the Court of Appeals used as its basis for, or as the foundation for its holding, that the under the Relinquishment Act, the landowner owes the state only those duties expressly set forth in the Act. Why is that not true? And the Act says nothing about a fiduciary duty.
It says nothing about fiduciary duty.
Well, why is the Court of Appeals incorrect?
Well, let's see. I recognize that only to have been perhaps an aside in this court's opinion in Wallace Scott, of course, but as the court recalls, in the footnote in Wallace Scott suggested that historic public policy was fiduciary and duty on the Relinquishment Act service owner. It seems to me that the whole body of law that this Act is going to be construed, reaffirmed in Scott, strictly in favor of the state and the protection of its minerals means has to mean something. Those are just not words. That means something is taking place here and that some duty is being imposed. And the only way you construe this Act strictly in favor of the state and the protection of its trust fund is to say that its agent has traditional duties of an agent. Settled law in terms of construction is, of course, that the legislature, albeit maybe an unreasonable presumption, that the legislature understood the word agency, they understood the law at the time, and they would not have used the term without putting into place its conventional and accepted meaning, which was principal agent law. Those are the construction terms that are used here. The Court of Appeal also said that the agency terminated with the execution of the lease, and that, of course, is flatly contrary to, again, as we read Wally Scott, and again, totally contrary to the standard case, which said that the agency was continuing and perpetual. The Court of Appeals said, well, it terminated because of drainage, but that can't be, because the drainage portions of the Relinquishment Act say if there was drainage, the state gets the full 1/8. The court there wasn't enforcing some drainage notions under the Relinquishment Act when he confirmed this lease. The court said, I treated this as a valid lease. Senator Yarbrough, who represented the state at the time, thought it was a valid lease. No one questioned it, and only later, as the years unraveled, did we find that, of course, it was not. It was not what it was represented to be, and of course that's why in the later events that occurred in the reconveying of the working interest to Turner and his colleagues, those events were not before the court in Reed, and of course that's why it's not res judicata in the Reed judgment. It confirmed what was represented to be a valid arm's length transaction, which was really a phony deal.
So Mr. Turner was an agent for the state for the rest of his life, regardless of what he did with
that's
interest.
If you read Wally Scott says that, as I understand it, that, I made a wrong oil company here, I think it's Exxon, could not participate in the benefits because they had not done their duties of the agent trying to pursue this benefit. Well, Exxon, that was a lease that was 60, 70 years old by that point. Exxon had not even been the original participant. So I see Scott seems to me to suggest that the duties do continue. And, of course, standards said they were continuing and perpetual. That's what this court said in standards. So I think that gives us at least some basis in the decisions of this court to say there's an ongoing and not terminable duty. I'll reserve the rest of my time if I may.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Cecil Munn and Mr. Charles Tye will present argument for respondents. Mr. Tye will begin.
May it please the court, two of the respondents, Mr. Fletcher Yarber for the Hunts and Mr. Ed Small for the Collards have agreed to relinquish their time because of the limitations on time. They are here with their clients and are vitally interested that they submitted from their briefs. The one thing that the counsel for the state said that I certainly agree with is that we are handicapped by the fact that we are here talking about something that happened more than 50 years ago. Something that happened 50 years ago in court. What is peculiar to me is that not only through all the proceedings, but here in this court, in fact, in the excerpts that has been presented to you and in the argument, not one word has been said about what we believe is one of the most vital things that happened in the lawsuit in the courthouse between these same parties talking about the same land some 55 years ago, and that's the order appointing the receiver. And I'm sorry it is not larger. I had thought it would be large enough that everybody could read, but if I could go over it with you. After the lawsuit was filed in 1933, the court in that petition asked that a receiver be appointed. The court did not say, the state did not say, incidentally, we've got an agent and we're going to rely upon him. What the court said was that this, what the state said was that this property has been sitting out there. There's a dispute as to who owns it. We're being drained. It's been going on for 5 years and we've got to have a well on that. We can't trust anybody to do it. And they went into court and said to the court, Court, we want you to do that for us. And that's precisely what happened, and that's precisely what destroyed whatever the relationship was between the state and Mr. Turner. On the board, I have excerpts simply out of the order appointing that receiver. That receiver was appointed at the request of the court of the state, upon the application of the state, to take actual charge in possession of this tract. The court, after a hearing apparently, no record, said it appearing to the court that no well has been drilled, that it's been drained for 5 years, I've got to do something. Now that language in and of itself, if you look at the Act, section I believe 5670 of the 1919 Act, it has the ipso facto language in it. And what it says is if those conditions exist and no well has been drilled within 100 days of the time the drainage starts, then that relationship is terminated. In fact, that's what Norman B. Giles says. Norman B. Giles is a very interesting case on that point because it says when that happens, that relationship is absolutely ipso facto terminated. It's gone. State can deal with it then, and there are provisions for it. The court went on in this opinion, in the order appointing, to say that the appointment is necessary to protect the state's interest. And he asked the receiver to take immediate possession of this tract. And for the defendants, all those claiming any interest in it, to surrender possession. That possession is exclusive as to all, against all persons whomsoever, according to the court. And then he says to the receiver, under the direction of this court, I want you to do something. I want you not only to take possession of that property, keep it away from these people, I'm going to order them not to have anything to do with it, but then I'm going to ask you to go out and test the market so that I can make my own determination as to what I want to do with it. The court then gets back up from that receiver that he has appointed. He's not looking to Mr. Turner for this. In fact, the evidence is very clear that the state took over negotiating the bonus. They're very proud of that bonus. They advertised it. Used it as a way in the Yates Field to get an increase in the bonus. These grass over here, incidentally, they don't show anything different from any other lease in the Yates Field. Every Yates Field lease could show those same figures. That is, the state gets a 1/16th and somebody else gets the rest of it. Here, the state had an opportunity to get that red tower over there. State had an opportunity because here, one of the bids that came in, that was presented before the court, was the Epinar bid, and it has everything in there. It has an opportunity for the state to lease that property and get $1.6 million for it, but they don't get the $1.6 million unless there's production. So they had that opportunity. They had the opportunity to have that well drilled for nothing and to get a fourth of the working interest. And if they didn't want to do that, they had the opportunity in the third one to just have the well drilled and to be paid out of production. When Senator Yarber testified, I said, golly, wouldn't it have been a lot better for the state to take that Eisenhower deal? What a great thing. Then they'd have had that red deal. What he said was, you never know what's going to be down there. The state has alleged that's been drained for years. That may be gone. We don't know. There's enormous pressure in the petition, enormous pressure in that field, and it's going to cost a lot of money to develop that field. Understandable that the state didn't want that. Understandable that what they wanted was the big bonus, and a bonus of $5,000 in 1934, I guess I was 6 years old, that's the equivalent to how much it cost to drill the well, a huge bonus. But the state had the opportunity if they wanted to do that, and what the state said, clearly, when they asked the court to take over, they said to the court, we want you to take care of us. We want you to protect our interest in this matter. And whether it was the state rejecting this, or whether it was the court, after a hearing, after a trial that we don't have any record on, that we don't have a statement of facts on, whether it was the court saying, I've looked at all these deals, and incidentally, here's another proposal that comes in. The receiver still has control of this property.
It seems to me your argument begs the question, though, because if Mr. Turner was the owner of the property, confirmed by the court to be the owner, then he was the agent, to some extent, of the state. And whether he dealt, assuming the state's argument, whether he dealt to himself through the receiver and the court or through the state individually, what difference does it make?
I think if at the end of the, if when the judge vested title in the circus in Mr. Turner, if the state at that point in time had said, we're satisfied with that, now we'll dismiss our lawsuit and we now will look to Mr. Turner to give us a lease, that would be one thing. But what they didn't do that. What they did after the title was vested, they continued to look to the court, and the court, in effect, then changed the lease, added to the lease. And the title instrument is not the lease itself. The title instrument is that judgment that was fashioned by the court.
But the allegation in this case is that the state's agent dealt with himself. And if he dealt with himself through the receiver, through the court's receiver, and the court itself, or just through the state, what difference does it make?
Well,
if he's dealing with himself, he's dealing with himself.
There is no way to know what representations or what the testimony was to the judge. Absolutely no way to know that. It's curious. The state comes in and says, the one thing we've got to have is a well. We've got to have a well. It's understandable. Nothing in the judgment about the well. It's being drained. We've got to do something. How in the world could they have had any kind of a hearing where the state didn't leave there with comfort that a well was going to be drilled? The lease was a 10-year lease without a drilling requirement. What I'm saying is I don't believe, if you presume, have presumptions in favor of the judgment, how can you possibly say that the presumption wasn't that there was going to be a well drilled and as to who was going to drill it? We simply don't know. We simply don't know that.
So we can't look behind that judgment for any purpose to see whether or not Mr. Turner was guilty of fraud or self-dealing before the entry of the judgment.
I think that's the whole idea of the sanctity of contract, leading to res judicata. You've got to have, even though the statute of limitations doesn't run against the state, you've got to have a finality of judgment. And that was decided at that time as to what interest, what party was going to get. And the state specifically at that time said, we don't have a working interest. They didn't appeal from that judgment. They accepted that. And what that judgment says is that the state is not going to have a working interest. And what you have now is a situation where, with the benefit of hindsight, with the benefit of having ridden the well down, the state comes in and says, hey, we back up. At the time of that trial, we took option A, or the judge gave us option A because he thought that was best for us, but we don't want that anymore. We now want to go to option B.
If Mr. Turner did plot this all out and scheme to defraud the state out of its revenues, out of this land, and presented this plan to the receiver and the trial court with that in mind, would there be liability?
I don't believe there would, because at that time he was not the agent of the state. They had absolutely kicked him out.
Only as to possession, though, right?
Well, they had deprived him of the right to manage the property, to contract for it, to do anything for it.
But they didn't deprive him of the ownership of it.
No, they didn't deprive him of the ownership.
In fact, his ownership was confirmed by the trial court.
It was confirmed by the trial court, and after that time, the court still was dealing with it to the exclusion of him. The other thing I'd say is, under the ipso facto termination language, I think it is clear in the findings of the court in the receiver's bid that there had been an ipso facto termination. That's automatic. That doesn't depend upon a finding or anything, if those facts exist. And the state, in fact, in the petition, it was a sworn petition that those facts existed. So I think that's another way that you destroy that relationship.
Apart from the ipso facto, if Turner was only dispossessed and his ownership rights were not vitiated, in fact, they were later confirmed by the trial court, doesn't that still make him the agent under the statute?
I don't think that in this instance that you can treat him as the agent with any duties where you have, ipso facto aside, where you have the state going into court and saying, we're not going to rely upon him. We want the court to take care of our interest in him. I was going to say something else, but one other comment I want to make about the, what I was going to say was, Justice, you referred to it. I think it's so easy in this day and time to say, well, back at that time, the duty must have been such and such. You have to look at the act. You have to look at the act, and it says clearly that he can assign, can lease to any person, firm, or corporation. It's interesting that in the 85 amendment to the act, there are specific authorizations for the surface owner to own a working interest, which implies, I think, that prior to that time, there certainly was no restriction on it, and the restriction of free assignability in the judgment is clearly there. When you start speculating about what may have happened in this trial that took 2 days, where we don't have any record, it's not hard to imagine that there was discussion about, is this lease freely assignable? Sure it is. Can it be assigned to anybody? Sure it can. Because the state had already said, as strong as you can, we are not willing to get into the working interest business. We're not willing to take that risk. Another thing that I think is
your green light flashed. You may not have seen it. Flashed during your last answer. I'm just advising you that.
Oh, all right. I thought there would be a 2 minutes. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. But two other things I want to say. Res judicata, Mr. Munn will comment about that. A comment was made that the state just recently found this out. One of the points that we have is ratification, and that has to do with the fact that in 1967 and 1968, a full disclosure of all of this information was made to the state. At that time, Mr. Nola White, who was an assistant attorney general, and Mr. Richardson, who had just tried the state, the, which one? The standard case, within a year, they reviewed all of the information. And wrote a letter saying, in effect, that we don't find any cause of action here. But they knew that in 1967. This is not something that was found out discovered 2 or 3 years ago. The other thing I would say, that the assignments to Mr. Turner of his working interest or his interest under this lease was of record in Pecos County in 1934. The corporate records were public records. I think it would seem strange to Judge Wheeler to hear this argument that is made when the state did everything it could back in 1934 to say, we don't want to rely upon Mr. Turner. We're going to test the market ourselves. We found what we want. We found what we don't want. The judgment gave them what they did, what they wanted, didn't give them what they didn't want, and they did not appeal from it.
The state contends that there are over 1,400 active Relinquishment Act leases at this time. What is your assessment of the impact of this case on other leases in the state?
I don't recall that there was any testimony in the record. I think it was added in, but assuming that is so, we in effect invited them in one of our pleadings and say, tell us where there is another one where you had a lawsuit involving the same property, the same parties, where you had a receiver appointed, and where you have the same issues raised. I don't think it has any application to any other one except this one, because I'm not aware of any situation where that existed.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
May it please the court, I have an advantage over Mr. Tye. I was 11 years old in 1934. In this court's review of a summary judgment, it seems to me that the logical beginning is to look at the undisputed points. This first of four charts does that. The state agreed on the record that the lease we are talking about, as modified and approved by the court, is neither void nor voidable. That was stipulated. The references as to where are contained on this document, and each of your honors has a copy in this orange cover slant. The state has stated on the record that they recognize that they cannot impeach the judgment and are not attacking it or attempting to go behind it. It is undisputed that the state recognizes that when there is a contradiction between a judgment and what some witness wants to testify to, that whether the court follows the judgment or the witness's testimony is, of course, a question of law. And finally, as the state itself so eloquently said, that when a title matter is before the court and that dispute is adjudicated by determination of title, the dispute ends. Chart 2 is a walkthrough of the title determinations made by the court in 1934. The court decided in its judgment that Mr. Turner owned the surface, the state owned the minerals. The court further decided that the royalty, cost-free royalty, should be divided so that the state would receive 1/16 of the bounty, and that Mr. Turner and his assigns would receive 1/16 of the royalty. As to the working interest, which of course is not cost-free, the judgment says that that working interest was vested in Mr. Faskin, the named lessee approved in the judgment. In that connection, as we walked in the courtroom this morning, we were handed the green foldouts by counsel for the state. The first line, first page, contains a 10-year error, which has been tradition as we've gone through here. It's not totally reliable, but it's of little significance there. Of more significance, the heart of the matter is on the quotation that the state inserts from the testimony of Mr. Knickerbocker, who was at outs with the Turner heirs. Here it is verbatim. Question: what interest did Mr. Faskin own in the oil and gas lease? Answer: it was in his name only. He never owned any interest, and he had no interest. So what your honors are confronted with is an argument by the state that you should ignore a 50-year-old judicial determination that he did have an interest, and accept in its place the memory, the word of one man who says, I disagree with that judgment, and who incidentally wasn't even near the courtroom when the judgment was entered. Mr. Fasken did have an interest. He was real. In fact, the testimony from the deposition of the Exxon Corporation shows that between 1934 and 1937, Mr. Fasken himself was individually paid $174,953 in cash because of his interest in this lease. That testimony is at page 7, I believe, of our green response to the application for writ of error. But most importantly, the court said that the interest that Mr. Fasken has, the working interest, 7/8, is assignable, fully and completely assignable, and said that in the case. Probably Judge Wheeler asked, who's going to drill the well? Do you have a contractor? What arrangements? Who's going to put up the money? Who's going to finance it? If we're to speculate about what is behind that judgment, that's a logical speculation. But if we're not to speculate, take it at face value. It says that Mr. Fasken and his assigns had 14/16 or 7/8 of the working interest, which, as Mr. Tye points out, all this chart shows is that 15/16 is more than 1/16, and that would apply to every single Relinquishment Act lease in the Yates Field. Now, what happened after the judgment was entered, the subsequent title history? Chart 3 shows this. The top of the chart shows the basic division, the lessor's royalty interest. That's cost-free, risk-free. The state got a half of it, Turner got a half. As to the working interest, the state, as Mr. Tye pointed out, wanted no part of that. And Mr. Fasken assigned the east half of the working interest to a man by the name of M.D. Bryant. And incidentally, neither he nor his successors are parties to this lawsuit. So even if anyone wanted to challenge the lease and could do it, proper parties, the indispensable parties, are not before the court. Mr. Fasken reserved the 3/16 overriding royalty interest. As to the west half of the lease, he assigned it to Midland Producing Company. Now, what is Midland Producing Company? The lower chart, half of this chart, shows that. It shows the shareholders in Midland Producing Company, the number of shares of each, and the apparent consideration given for those shares. Mr. Fasken conveyed his 14/16 working interest in the west half and his royalty interest in the east half for 47.5 shares of stock in that corporation, which he retained for several years and finally sold them later to Mr. Turner. The other interest owners, including the Candy Hanger and McMahon Partners, gave valid consideration for those shares. The shares were assignable to Midland Producing Company, and that's how the title descended. Let me digress a moment from the charts and say, call your attention to two pieces of testimony. First, Mr. Jim Phillips, who is general counsel of the General Land Office, testifying. Question, pursuant to the court authorization for assignments of interest in the lease, Mr. Fasken made one assignment of a working interest to M.D. Bryant and one assignment of an interest, working interest, to Midland Producing, didn't he? Answer, that's an accurate statement. Now, as to all this supposed secrecy, the evil is in the eye of the beholder, I suggest. Here is Commissioner Morrow's testimony. Question, we were referring to a letter called to his attention that's been in the files of the land office, and Chief Justice Phillips mentioned public records, that is one of them, since June of 1934, written by the law firm of Candy Hanger and McMahon to the Commissioner of the General Land Office. Question, this is from your files, incidentally, is it not? Yes. Question, there was no concealment of the fact that the west half of this lease was assigned by Mr. Faskin to the Midland Producing Company, and the county hanger lawyers, I'll call them for short, were attorneys for the Midland Producing Company, correct? That is absolutely correct. No concealment, no evidence that anything was concealed from Judge Wheeler. And anyone who says something was concealed from Judge Wheeler has to say that he sat through the entire trial and that he is in a position to testify to everything that was told to the court, submitted to the court, heard by the court, or read by the court. No living human being can do that. Chart 4, the final chart in this group, shows the title as it has descended through these many years, and that was accurate as of the time it was prepared and entered in evidence, November 1984. Since that time, there have been deaths, there have been estates, there may have been transfers, but it does give the court a view of the complexity of the title that would be challenged if 57 years later this court should hold that this case should be retried. My conclusions from this, as an officer of the court, are three. First, as a matter of law, this title was established by the 1934 judgment and subsequent assignments of record, and it is that judgment and that record that creates this very normal division, which is made to look horrible when put on a board with dramatic colors, but really only tells the court that a working interest is substantially larger than a royalty interest in a lease. The second conclusion is that as a matter of law, the right to the production and the proceeds of production, of course, follows the right to the title as adjudicated by the court in 1934. And third, therefore, the summary judgment granted below was correct and should be affirmed. In my view, the case is just that simple and could be handled just that way. We don't need to go into the somewhat esoteric questions as to just what the relationship of the parties were if there had been no trial in 1934 and what each should have done and what the state would have done. Of course, the state didn't want to take a working interest. Where would it have got the money? That would have taken a legislative appropriation. There was no provision for such a thing. State wasn't wanting to go in the oil business. The state says that they're not collaterally attacking that judgment, but they are. And I take that from the very prayer of the petition, and that's the heart of the case. The state says, I'm quoting, they're asking for, quote, judgment for the state for all benefits received by the defendants and their predecessors entitled from the production, and a declaration that the state is the owner of all interests now claimed by the defendants in the tract. In other words, 8/8 is what they want. Further evidence that the state is collaterally attacking the judgment is the fact that at the injunction hearing, where they tried to cut off the runs so these people couldn't defend themselves, they put on the stand a Mr. Billy Lancaster, who sponsored plaintiff's exhibit, or yes, their plaintiff's exhibit 32, to articulate the state's claim, and it was nothing but a tabulation of all 8/8 of the production from part, namely the west half of this lease. A brief word on policy considerations. I think there are three. First, stability of judicial decrees. Only last year, this court in Berry versus Berry told the bar, told the public, told the lawyers, told the parties, quote, unappealed judgments which are regular upon their face are not vulnerable to collateral attack. I sat through the earlier argument today, and I was moved by Justice Doggett's question, the effect of which is, cannot the state settle something, have a judgment, and have litigation be terminable? I was moved by the position of the state that after all, this is res judicata. It precludes an attack on a judicially approved redistricting statement. If that means I'm out of time, I should stop.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honor, I have my moments remaining. Res judicata is not applicable for at least three very serious reasons. Estoppel by judgment is only as to facts and issues that existed at the time the judgment was rendered. Tab, never alluded to by the defendants, tab 7 shows a contract entered into on April 14, 1934, 10 days after judgment, whereby Fastin reassigns to Turner significant portions of the working interest in the lease. That contract was tendered by the parties to Mobil Oil in 1934 as the basis for the division of the proceeds from this lease, the production from this lease. It was represented by the representatives of Turner Estate recently, I guess in the 1970s, as the contract which governs the distribution. Now, this is the deal. Everything was obviously verbal before the judgment. Then they signed this contract. It's tab 7, and it makes a specific conveyance by Fastin back to Turner of significant portions of the working interest, and also says we're going to go make a corporation, and we'll run it all through the corporation and reassign it. Now, that's what happened, and it's in the record, and it cannot be, it seems to me, disputed, at least at this stage again.
Mr. Richards, what difference does it make if Fastin didn't have that working interest that was assignable to anybody?
That's right. The question is it assignable to the universe, or we've come full circle. Can a relinquishment act agent engage in self-dealing with the principal's property without disclosing it to the principal? If we don't attach any significant duties or no duty to the relinquishment act surface owner, I suppose it's okay. The question is there a duty? Compare it to Neighbors. That's what happened in Neighbors versus McCord. 15 days after the original deal, the agent took the property back. And this court unanimously said, this is a violation. This is self-dealing. Even though it was after the, 15 days later.
Don't you concede that this case differs from all other Relinquishment Act cases because there has been no judgment or trial in these other relinquishment cases?
Well, let's look at Standard. Standard was a case in which this court had issued a mandamus to the Commissioner of the General Land Office to validate a lease. I mean, that's about as strong a judgment, I suppose, as anyone could issue. It was discovered later that the lease that this court ordered validated was, in fact, not the true lease, in the words of the court. This was not the true lease. We found out that indeed the surface owner there had cut himself a side deal in which he could reacquire a 16th of the working interest. Res judicata was asserted when the state came in that case, and this court said, wait, that's not res judicata because the lease we confirmed was not the true lease. It turns out the true lease was a deal whereby the surface owner was going to reacquire an interest. That's precisely what happened here. The true lease, the true arrangement was Fastin was going to give it back to Turner. He gave it back to Turner, and that's what's resulted. That, as we understand, is basic res judicata law in Texas. We're suing for damages. We're just like, as I see it, just like the plaintiff in Kinsback. We're not going to vitiate. We're not going to avoid it. We're going after the buyer agent who ran off with these undisclosed profits. That's our right, we think, under conventional agency law in Texas. Now, granted, if you decide not to attach meaningful duties to an agent under the Relinquishment Act, they may come home free. And I will say, let me just say this, that
before you proceed, why is it not, or what answer do you give to the argument that's been made, I think, which has a certain appeal to it, that the state made some choices, option A or option B. They chose option A, and now they found out years later, option B was a lot better on hindsight, and so you're trying to go back and change the choice that you made initially in 1934.
I think the answer to it was posed in part by Justice Heck's question. And that is, the state didn't have that choice. As I understand, this was a temporary receivership. It is clear as a matter of Texas law, First Southern Properties, that a temporary receivership cannot destroy or alter vested property rights. Once Turner was determined to be the surface owner by that judgment, and that's what the judgment said, he is the surface owner, that judgment conferred to him as a matter of right, the right to execute the lease. And let me say about that, the court's judgment is explicit in that regard. Turner is a surface owner, and that he has executed a valid and subsisting lease to Fastin. court, the lease was never proffered to the receiver. It was proffered only to the court. The court discharged the receiver, found a lease that seemed to be okay on its face. And Senator Yarber has testified, maybe they don't have any witnesses who will so testify, but Senator Yarber was there and said no one ever told us that there was some side deal here, and if we had, we never would have stood still for it because it would have been a fraud on the court. Now, that's the record testimony.
Was Senator Yarber in court when this case was litigated in 1934?
Yes, he was a lawyer for the state of Texas.
In 1934?
That's right. No, he was the lawyer for the state of Texas, handled the case, handled all this litigation for the Attorney General's office during the 1930s.
Under your view of the case, though, it appears that the pendency of the receivership and the judicial proceedings don't impact on the result at all.
Well, I'm not sure of that. I'm saying it seems to me that receivership is a temporary one. It was discharged. The court chose not to rely on the receiver, chose to accept the Fasten lease, and confirms Turner as a surface owner. By the way, that was all part of a private settlement agreement. The state was not a party to the agreement. The private litigant, Brian Reed, and the others, but they would all agree that Turner was a surface owner. The judgment is obviously significant, and if the judgment had stated the deal, I suppose that would be the end of the hunt. But the judgment said Turner was going to get a 1/16, that Fasten was going to get a 7/8, that Fasten was going to pay a bonus, but that wasn't what the facts were. Now, in fact, the facts are described, and the events occurred 10 days later when the parties signed their contract on April 14th, and Fasten reconveyed to Turner significant portions of the working interest and agreed to form and reconveyed the balance through the guise of the middle producer.
Some assertion that that was not actually signed that day, but...
Let me answer those quickly. It was tendered by these parties to then Humble Oil in 1934 and has been the basis since 1934 of Humble Oil making all the divisions on this lease.
But even the agreement itself bears
There's type signatures. It was tendered by, but keep in mind, it was tendered by these parties to Humble Oil as the basis for the division order that issued and has been the basis for the division order at all times since that time, as recently as the 1970s, so represented to be by the executive of the state of Fred Turner Jr. Thank you.
Any other questions? That concludes the argument. And the second call, the court will take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.